You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A little over 42 years ago, on March 16, 1968, somewhere between 347 and 504 unarmed citizens in South Vietnam, all of whom were civilians, a majority of whom were women, children, including babies and elderly people, were killed in the hamlets of My Lai and My Khe in the Son My village. But learning what really happened in that event has come to be known as the My Lai Massacre has been difficult because the people who know all the answers have a lot to lose in telling the truth. My Lai, an exhaustive documentary investigation into the event that Barack Goodman wrote, produced, and directed, airs tonight as part of the PBS series American Experience. Mr. Goodman's has had a film nominated for an Academy Award. He's won several Emmys and Writers Guild Awards, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Are there still things that remain unclear about what happened?
I think that the documentary record of what happened is fairly clear. The why, though, is an eternal mystery that I think will always be there.
Well, you got some soldiers from Charlie Company to talk with you. Haven't they refused to speak publicly about what happened?
There are a small group of soldiers who have spoken out before, but we were able to tap into about a dozen Charlie Company members who hadn't ever spoken. And that was my goal in making the film and I think provides really the richness in the film.
And they admit to having killed innocent Vietnamese civilians. Did they try to justify what they did?
You know, their feelings are very complex. They are both remorseful and at the same time, I think most of them feel that they've been mischaracterized over the years. They've been judged unfairly. And I felt sincerely that I really wanted to hear their side of the story because these guys were not anomalous. They were very, very, you know, run-of-the-mill, regular American kids. And I didn't believe in the theory that they were some sort of bad apples. I wanted to know what had happened here.
Haven't there been massacres and wars throughout our history? Is there something about this one that makes it different?
I don't think it is different. I think it's different in scale, perhaps, and it's different. It's different by virtue of the fact that it was photographed extensively. And I think that probably accounts for its notoriety. But certainly, there were other massacres in Vietnam. There have been massacres throughout history, and I think the timeliness of this film is that there are conditions, exactly the same kinds of conditions, apply in Afghanistan right now, and we're probably going to see similar things if we're not careful.
As you said, you wanted to point out that these people were not anomalous. But the massacre was quite horrifying. It was also reported that many of the victims were sexually abused, beaten, tortured. Some of the bodies have been mutilated. Did they address how they could go so far from being just normal, in fact, rather nice guys earlier in the war to that?
They absolutely addressed it, and I think that is, you know, it provides a lot of what the film's about, is this slide from kind of normalcy into a state of pent-up, almost frenzied anger and a desire for vengeance. And that is the sort of the arc of the film, is how do they go from that one state to the other? And how does war do it, and how did this war do it in particular, and how did the strategy adopted by the higher-ups in this war contribute to that slide? But now I should point out that the majority of Charlie Company members did not engage in the truly horrific mutilations of bodies and so on. That was a smaller subset within the company.
And would they have been the ones who would have been most likely to have done that? I mean, could you have predicted before the massacre?
You know, in some ways you could have. Like any group of people, there are bad actors, and some of the people who did the worst, most egregious things had already demonstrated their willingness to beat up and rape and mutilate civilians. But you also saw people who were in every way dutiful soldiers. In fact, that might have been the reason that they participated in this. They felt it was an order that they had been given, and they wanted to execute that order. So it really did range the gamut, but some of the sort of most horrific actions were clearly done by people who were fringe soldiers to begin with, and that's part of the story, is why were they in the Army to begin with?
You've divided the documentary into roughly three acts, the lead-up, the massacre itself, and then the cover-up and eventual exposure of the incident and how the public reacted. In the first segment, you introduce us to the men of Charlie Company, and they seemed to be rather nice soldiers before they wound up going into that area of the military called Pinkville.
They were unquestionably normal bread and butter American kids. They were college educated. Some of them, were sort of more blue collar kinds of folks. But there was nothing strange or different about them. Their training, in fact, they had excelled in their basic training. This had been a sort of marked out as one of the better companies and was sent as an advanced unit to Vietnam to establish camp because they had done so well. The theory that the U.S. military spun out at first, which was that somehow this had been a bad group, was clearly off the mark from the beginning.
Well, the documentary suggests that it was also the circumstances of Vietnam and the way the war was conducted and the frustration that they had, even trying to be nice and then not being rewarded for that, that kept on exacerbating the situation.
Absolutely. What you see in the weeks and months before this event is this psychological breakdown of the company.
And does a company have a kind of a group psychology?
It does. Remarkably, I think that's been written about quite extensively, and the U.S. military is very aware of it. But and in this case, a lack of leadership to sort of intercede and intervene in the psychological process that was going on is one of the main reasons for My Lai happening. What went on is that they were detailed to a part of Vietnam that was particularly violent and a part of Vietnam where the mode of warfare was not face-to-face. It was mines, booby traps, and snipers, which is psychologically a very difficult kind of warfare to be in. You don't see your enemy. You're losing your buddies right and left. You don't know where to step, where to sit. These soldiers had expected a kind of more traditional World War II style war. One of the soldiers says in the film, we just wanted the snipers to come out. They would yell, come on out, and they wouldn't come out. And that was... They didn't speak English. Of course they wouldn't come out. That was the sort of ridiculous fallacy of this. And then you get to the middle of March. They've gone through this process of losing their buddies. They've begun to turn on the civilian population, which is the only Vietnamese they could see around them. And they're told on the night before the massacre that they will finally see face-to-face their enemy.
The most famous My Lai figure is Lieutenant William Calley, but you seem to suggest that Captain Ernest Medina's role deserved a lot more attention than it got.
Absolutely.
What was he like as a leader?
It's so fascinating because Ernest Medina is still regarded by the men of Charlie Company as a great hero to them. He was a sort of up from nothing guy who built himself up. He didn't go to West Point. He wasn't sort of a privileged kid. He worked his way to the captaincy of this unit and was revered by his men, loved by his men. He was a brave man, clearly, and someone who would lead them into battle no matter what the circumstances. But his problem was, or his failing was, that when this company began to engage in violence against civilians, he didn't intercede. He didn't stop them.
And he also had problems with Lieutenant Calley, didn't he? They did not relate well.
No, and that was a dynamic that contributed because Calley always wanted to prove himself to Medina, as they all did. But Medina and the rest of the men, for that matter, really detested Calley. And what Calley did on the day of the massacre, a lot of people think, was in an effort to please Captain Medina, to show his true grit as a soldier, as it were.
My guest is Barak Goodman, whose documentary My Lai is being shown tonight as part of the American Experience series on PBS. It runs on 9 p.m. here on Channel 13. Can you clear up some of the names? This is also known as the Son Mi Massacre. There's Pinkville, there's My Lai, there's My Kay, and the Son Mi.
It's tremendously complicated. It would take me an hour to clear it up. But the long and short of it is that My Lai is a U.S. construct for the set of small hamlets that comprise a larger village. And in fact, it's relevant, the fact that we are confused over the names, because one of the theories as to why the intelligence was so wrong about what happened this day is that we had actually misnamed the place, and we had heard that the Viet Cong would be in one place called My Lai, and it was actually far away in another place. So we came to the wrong place, essentially.
You mentioned the photographs, Ronald Heberle's terrifying photos of the incident, which became famous when they were finally published. Were you reminded of the reaction to the photos from Abu Ghraib when you saw these My Lai images again?
Yeah, the analogies are very strong, I think. And I think both of these incidents share in common the fact that but for these photographs, they might never really have been exposed. The photographs in My Lai are even more horrific, I think, in some ways, because what they depict are corpses and many corpses.
And even people who survived, as you discovered when you spoke to some of the survivors, were buried under corpses.
Yeah.
It must have been horrific for them. Were they easy to track down?
They were. There's, again, a certain group of My Lai survivors who are often trotted out by the government of Vietnam to talk to reporters and writers and so on. But we wanted to go beyond that group, and we had the help of a wonderful fixer, a guy in Vietnam who grew up right near this village and who knew the people of this village very well and was able to find for us a set of people who hadn't spoken.
Are they still living there?
They had come back to My Lai. My Lai's been resurrected. This is the place they knew, and once they became refugees as children, they naturally gravitated back to where they had grown up, and so they're living there now.
Did their accounts of the day's events match up with what you were hearing from the members of Charlie Company?
To a remarkable degree, the memories are in sync with each other. In fact, they describe actual incidents in the course of the massacre which precisely line up. We have one moment where there was one hero in the story who interceded in the massacre and actually rescued some of the civilian members of this village, and he describes pulling a child out of a ditch. We went and found that child, now grown to an adult, and he also describes the soldier pulling him out in the ditch with remarkable similarities in their stories.
You're talking about Hugh Thompson, one of the heroes of this story. He was a pilot who witnessed what was going on and said, we have to put a stop to this?
Hugh Thompson is the moral center of the film and really the redemptive force in this whole story. He was a helicopter pilot, a very brave one, who was flying kind of a support mission with two machine gunners with him. And when he saw what was happening, he had not been a member of Charlie Company, and that's important. He was with a different unit. But when he observed what was happening, within half an hour of seeing what was going on, he had decided essentially that he had to intervene. And he landed his helicopter between the civilians and the oncoming U.S. soldiers and actually had his door gunners train their machine guns on the U.S. forces, which was, of course, a high crime in war, but he did it anyway, and he evacuated a certain number of these civilians, and then blew the whistle on the whole thing, and it stopped largely because of his intervention.
On the other hand, didn't he pay a steep price for that? If I remember correctly, he and two others were denounced by U.S. congressmen. They were sent hate mail and death threats. Found mutilated animals on their doorsteps.
Yes, Hugh Thompson paid a huge price for this. He was pariah in the U.S. military, which was his life for several decades. And it wasn't until, on towards the 90s and into the 2000s that the U.S. military belatedly acknowledged what he had done and gave him the highest civilian honor, not the highest non-combat honor they could give a soldier. But he had suffered enormously before that.
Were any of the people, Lieutenant Kelly was sentenced to prison but only served a brief term. Were any of the other people involved, Medina, the various officers who engaged in a cover-up of horrifying proportions, were any of them punished at all?
They were given slaps on the wrist. I mean, several of them had sort of their career sort of arrested in they didn't advance any further, but no one served any real time. No one was really punished. There was just no appetite at the time to punish these guys. And Callie, as you say, had been given a life sentence, but Nixon intervened in various ways and essentially commuted his sentence, and he served only 4 months in the brig.
And the 26 other soldiers who were charged were never even brought to trial.
That's correct. I mean, the U.S. military didn't even have jurisdiction over many of the perpetrators because they were already mustered out of the Army. And at that point, there's no way to punish them. So it was this curious combination of circumstances that sort of led to these guys walking away from this.
It's interesting that we so often hear about Vietnam vets complaining that they came back and everybody called them baby killers and spit on them and all that. And here we have a situation where the public support is strongly for Lieutenant Calley and the other members of Charlie Company.
That was one of the biggest surprises to me, is that shortly after the revelation of this and Calley's going on trial, there was this very strange convergence of the left and the right in support of Calley. The left felt that we were scapegoating Lieutenant Calley for the sins of the higher-ups, the military establishment, the politicians, and why should this one guy suffer the consequences of this war when it was really all their faults. The right, of course, felt he hadn't done anything wrong. He was just doing his duty in Vietnam, and why should he be imprisoned for that? So there was this huge popular uprising after his conviction, and Nixon, being the political animal that he was, listened to it and intervened, and that's why Calley escaped punishment.
Mike Hale gave you a great review in today's New York Times, but he said that you had to leave out a lot. Did you feel that you were leaving out a lot?
I really didn't feel that way. I respect Mike Hale's thoughts on that.
Well, you liked every other word of the review, I'm sure.
He particularly pointed out the fact that we didn't get Cy Hirsch in there, which I do regret. Cy Hirsch, Seymour Hirsch, was the reporter who broke the story of Mila, essentially. We had invited Seymour Hirsch, and he declined. But, you know, it was too bad. But other than that, I think we were able to cover a large amount of the story, and sure, there are things I naturally would have wanted in there, but for the most part, it's all there.
Why do you think we have the kind of reaction we had to the revelations about Milai? I mean, some people were shocked, but it's amazing how many people rallied around the flag. We had the same experience with Abu Ghraib. The rest of the world, is it because the rest of the world then condemns America?
That's certainly part of it. We can condemn our own war, but we don't want others doing it. But I think equally important is there is an empathy for these guys. We know that these are our boys over there, and we know that they're young, and we know that they're in difficult circumstances. And we know that there's something called the fog of war, which overtakes most wars, and that people are not able to act as they would as civilians in such a circumstance. And it's hard to draw bright lines about what is a moral actor in war and what isn't, and what are the rules and what aren't the rules. And I think that's one of the sources of richness in this story is what would any one of us have done in those circumstances.
I suspect we're going to have some American experience show 20 years down the line dealing with something that happened in Afghanistan or Iraq. Is it possible for that not to happen?
It's very, very difficult. These are wars in which the soldiers don't know who is with them and who is against them. They don't know which moment they're going to die or see their buddies die. And that inevitably leads to a certain amount of anger and frustration that's going to seek an expression. I think there are things we can
killing
do.
Killing infants is going a little overboard, isn't it? I know
certainly.
That they weren't. I doubt that those infants were members of the Viet Cong. Were there members of the Viet Cong nearby?
Well, again, it's a definitional thing. What is a member of the Viet Cong? The soldiers would say that many of these civilians were sympathizers and actively helped the Viet Cong. Were they members of the Viet Cong? No. Were these babies and children? Of course not. And that's, again, one of the eternal mysteries of My Lai is why didn't they stop at that point? How could they shoot children? And to this day, some of them don't acknowledge they had done anything wrong in that circumstance. And that's still bewildering to me.
Barack Goodman's film, he wrote, directed, produced it. It's called My Lai, and it's being shown tonight at 9 o'clock on Channel 13 as part of the PBS American Experience series. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Leonard.